Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today we're hopping into a normal set of episodes. We did, at the beginning of the year, we did a questions and answers episode, which was a lot of fun. It wasn't actually a lot of questions and answers, though. We did two big ones. I counted them up, and the requests I had for the two questions that we did, which was infant, a question about why do we baptize infants, that is, we Lutherans, or why would the Thinking Fellows advocate for such? And then we also had a question on apostasy, so we covered those two in that episode. I thought it was a really good episode. I would summarize the episode as being basically about as comfort and consolation of souls. So I thought that was a really good episode, so if you haven't listened to it, you should go check that out. Maybe you were one of the listeners who was wondering about that and had sent me an email about infant baptism or apostasy, and that episode is where your question is answered. We also did, before that, we did three episodes on defining our terms, and that, again, came from several listeners saying, hey, I really like the show. I listen to it weekly, and most of the time, I get it, but sometimes you guys use a term that I have no context or background for. And so what we tried to do in those episodes was take a couple minutes for some of the more common terms that we use in the show that, hey, maybe only the really, you know, formal, educated Lutherans know some of these terms, and sometimes we just sling them around real fast or something like that. Or we picked some important doctrines that we know come up reoccurring and that we've done whole episodes on, but it was worth it to do 3 or 4 minutes on those as well. So you should go back and listen to those if you're looking for kind of a breakup from the normal episodes that we did. We used those episodes as a transition and sort of like a reset button for the new years. Say, here we go. It's 2018. We're bringing the show to you in a different way this year. And the way that we're doing that is we, instead of doing the blocks of series that we had previously done, we are doing various different types or categories of episode every month. And so out of the 4 days a month that the show comes out, hopefully we'll have 4 topics in different category areas. And so today we're going to kick things off with an episode in church history. We did Great Thinkers of the Christian Faith, and we certainly didn't get around to every person that we wanted to cover. And today we're going to do somebody who's really important, I think, to all of us, whose writing is just vast and hugely impactful, and that is C.S. Lewis. Lewis is, I think, we're all pretty big fans of Lewis here. Most people, if you're not familiar with Lewis's explicitly theological and apologetic works, know him through fictional works. He's got The Chronicles of Narnia are probably the most famous thing that he's written, I would guess. Their young adult reading is what I would categorize him in. Is that correct?
He wrote them for children of his time. Yeah, it was children's literature in his own time.
And he said for people who haven't forgotten what it's like to be a child.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and as an adult, they're fantastic reading. They're just written in an accessible level, right? And while those works may not be theological textbooks, they are certainly theological, and the themes throughout parallel Christian doctrine and the narrative of the New Testament and Christ. So very profound. We're going to do basically the basic history of C.S. Lewis, maybe cover some of the big points in his life, and then maybe talk about the most influential works that we've read from him and that we think others should read if you haven't already. So maybe we begin. Rod, you are kind of like the resident Thinking Fellows expert on Lewis, right? You are kind of the core of that, right?
Adam and I are saying thanks, Caleb.
I mean, I know Scott has read everything.
Well, I'm.
I knew he existed.
Yeah, the truth is I'm just one of thousands.
Yes, yeah.
Just one of thousands.
So where would we begin? So we know that Lewis was born in 1898, so just at the before the turn of kind of Europe and the World Wars, right? And he dies in 1963.
Same day Kennedy was shot.
Interesting.
Yeah. And same day the author of Brave New World,
Huxley died.
Yeah. Died. All I think three. Peter Kreft wrote a book.
Mm-hmm. Of the three of them at a table.
Yeah, yeah.
If I was a conspiracy theorist, there would be something to that day.
I think the defining thing was that he had all kinds of problems with his father. and that he grew up miserably in the Anglican Church of his day and became an unbeliever as quickly as he could. Another thing that's germane, I think, he was known for his work in his own field in Renaissance English literature. He published scholarly works and is known for them in his field. The next thing I think that's really germane is that he became a Christian consciously at a pretty mature age. He had spent most of his life as an unbeliever and happily. There's a line in Surprised by Joy, and there I was kneeling by my bed, the unhappiest convert in all of England. And that first referred to theism, out of Hegelianism into theism, and then later his friend J.R.R. Tolkien pushed him on the deity of Christ. Liar, Lord, Legend, what? You know, there are only a few possibilities.
And listeners should definitely recognize that name as well, right? Author of the Lord of the Rings series, yep, and The Hobbit, yep, and some of the other books there as well.
And they would go to the pub and read their chapters to each other and critique. And it was a constant theme between Lewis and Tolkien. Tolkien said, Lewis, you're in Narnia, those are virtual quotations from John's Gospel. That's too explicit. And Lewis would answer back, Tolkien, if you don't nail this down more tightly, it'll float off the earth. And they never resolved it.
No, they actually got quite angry at each other over this discussion and several others. I mean, we sometimes paint the picture of...
And to be clear, this discussion is how to include your theology in,
yep,
your writing,
literature, yeah,
in your literature.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, we sometimes... I'm a big fan of the Inklings and the idea of the Inklings getting together in the pub with your male friends and reading one another's work and critiquing it.
Yep.
Moving back to the office when time gets too late and pouring the tea and doing the same thing, lighting the pipes and critiquing. In fact, Thinking Fellows in a lot of ways was sort of started as
embodies
like
an
Inkling-esque sort of endeavor. But Lewis and Tolkien, they had a great friendship, but it was sort of a contentious friendship too, which I think is wonderful. I've got a few of those myself. Sorry.
Why are you looking at me?
Well, it made it very, very clear that male philia survives disagreement at the cognitive level.
Right.
And that's very helpful. I mean, I would say some of my best friends are people I've had some of the most passionate arguments I've had with, or that I am very frustrated with for a while, but it doesn't stop me from getting back together with them, picking up from where we left off, and even leaving some of the heat that maybe came from one conversation behind to come, you know, be more peaceable about it.
Yep.
It defines, that's sort of, in my mind, one of the ways that defines a genuine friendship from one that is not, is the fact that you can disagree, have heated or passionate arguments about stuff, and then come back to being friends.
Another one that I think is worth mentioning. Lewis was wounded in World War I, and World War II, he went to Churchill and said, "What can I do for the war effort?" And Churchill answered, 9 out of 10 of these kids flying Spitfires are going to die in their cockpits. You seem to be able, better than the priests, to tell these kids how to get to heaven. That's how you could help the war effort. So night after night after night after night, he went to the RAF bases and did the text of what we now know as the Case for Christianity, the first 57 pages of Mere Christianity, over and over and over and over again.
And then also did it over the BBC radio.
Over the BBC, and they lost the tapes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they never lost the tapes on how to grow turnips in your backyard in London, but they lost the tapes of Lewis doing the Case for Christianity.
The transcript must have survived because you can buy it as radio talks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think a new copy. You'd have to find an out-of-print copy.
And the Episcopal Radio Station of America made sure that he read into, as audio, from his own handwritten notes what we know as the book The Four Loves. Mm-hmm. The book was published later.
And I believe you can still get that audio on Amazon. It's not like a regular audiobook. It's like an MP3, but...
Yep. I have it as an audio book off of iTunes.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so that's available too. There.
Lewis was a veteran himself of the First World War.
He was, and wounded.
So was Tolkien.
Right? In the trenches?
Yes.
I think he was wounded from shrapnel that landed that was somewhat far away, but
two of his buddies were killed, but he was wounded from...
Well, the thing that he's most known for, well, he's known for all sorts of things, but the thing he's most known for in Christian audiences is how well he uses English. He knows exactly the word to pick to do the job that he wants it to do and not another word.
Yeah.
This enables him to write clearly Christian doctrine and the defense of Christianity, apologetics, in very simple terms.
Right.
You almost never have Lewis making reference to a polysyllabic vocabulary.
Right.
He doesn't have to. Now, just with simple words, though, you'll find yourself saying, I need to go over that again. Why? Because it's profound.
Right. Yeah.
And he never does it by means of fake academies, ever, or jargon, Christian jargon. Doesn't touch it.
The other thing I think of him for quite a bit is not just the Chronicles of Narnia fiction, but some of the works of fiction that he wrote to get across very particular theological themes, like The Great Divorce, The Screwtape Letters. And, I mean, you can learn very, very specific theological concepts from Lewis as he's telling you a story.
Yes.
Which is...
amazing.
It's really amazing. I mean, The Great Divorce... the picture of heaven painted in The Great Divorce, if you're somebody like me who sort of struggles with the theology of heaven, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's...
And it's very... Yeah. I think one of the least known of his books because of the title.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with divorce.
No.
It has everything to do with what we might call a second chance. And people get a second chance, turn it down again. Turn the gospel down a second time.
Almost en masse.
Almost every one of them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. That's a great one. Abolition of Man's a sort of a whole different animal.
Oh, one of the greatest books of the century. It's Lewis's absolute howitzer attack on modern education.
And reasoning.
Yeah.
I read something not too long ago on Lewis's political views, and the author made some point. They talked about the abolition of man and how Lewis was deeply conservative, not in connection with the political party, but he was kind of like, I think it was the Russell Kirk who said, a conservative is somebody who stands athwart history and says stop.
Yeah, it was Buckley. And I don't know if he got
it. Oh, was it Buckley? Okay.
It was stands astride history and says stop.
Yeah, and the author of this article on Lewis said that Lewis, if he had a political philosophy, it was that. And I guess one time Lewis said that if he was ever voted into some sort of office, he would make it his sole policy to make sure that nothing happened.
Wow, that sounds like a regular Ron Swanson. He did not even attend the coronation. He was all for such.
Sure.
But he didn't bother in 53 to attend.
Well, you get the sense that he's patriotic and he cares deeply, especially when you know things like the war effort and asking
well,
how
two,
he can do
two
it.
World wars, right?
Yep.
So
yeah.
He serves in World War I as a soldier. He serves his country in World War II by providing, you know, a sense of really, especially in that first book, the Case for Christ,
Case for Christianity.
He's providing an objective reason. Mm-hmm. To believe for the soldiers to believe that what they're doing is right.
Yes,
you know, and good,
and the way he does that is to explicate basic Christianity in words that priests could not do, could not do it. But that's what Churchill charged him with: tell these kids how to go to heaven.
Yeah,
priests fail at it; you don't. Please do it.
Yeah, you could. I would say you could say. Patriotic, but he doesn't let that become a religion.
No.
Which is one of the, I mean, when you hear patriotism in modern America, a lot of times I see people just treating it like a religion.
Or, sure.
You know, God and country, putting them on the same tier, and you get the sense that he separated those, but it didn't mean that he didn't support people. And the way he supported them was with what was important and what we should always keep in mind, and that's delivering Christ and the hope that's there to people in things like war and disaster.
And the truth of the matter is, he will go down as the Christian apologist of the century, of the whole 20th century. Dr. Montgomery will be second.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
But Lewis will be first as a defender of the truth of the gospel, or a defender that Christianity is actually true. His audience is people who doubt.
Do you know where he learned his apologetics?
No.
Was it just him thinking about this?
Many times you find Lewis very humbly saying, for instance, of the clergy, well, they just read different books.
Right.
What Lewis had read was Aquinas, Augustine, and the classics.
Mm. Well, you have any good biography of Lewis, and even to some degree in Surprised by Joy, which is sort of his autobiography of coming to the faith.
Mm-hmm.
You're told the story of the tutor, right?
That mm-hmm. Kirkpatrick.
That prepped him for acceptance to Oxford.
Yep.
And that this tutor, taught him logic and Latin and classical literature with an intensity that I think we can't even imagine.
Sure. And Lewis just thrived
on
it.
Once he got a good tutor, he thrived on it. I mean, he struggled a bit in school prior to that.
So he's writing the great Christian classics, probably like the great British...
Yes.
William Paley. And
And getting the best sort of reasoning and instruction in reasoning in his time from somebody who really specializes in prepping students to accept a doctorate.
Didn't he do a lot of work in rhetoric? I know he's a prof of literature,
and writing.
Rhetoric was one of his specialties.
And inevitably, I think, and the same thing kind of with Dr. Montgomery, right? It's inevitably a different experience from somebody who comes from outside of the faith to inside of the faith that has that kind of training.
Absolutely.
In logic and in the sciences and an ability to reason and to think things through.
Yep. Not everybody has to do this, but in every century, a few have to for the sake of the rest of us.
Yeah, somebody who came from outside knows what those people are thinking or what might be effective
and
in getting to them.
He not only came from the outside, but he had a very specific training to be able to think through propositions and then explain the process of thinking them through.
Yep. Yeah, anything that our listeners read, almost anything of Lewis, you'll be the better for having read. And that includes short essays, collections of essays, even if you don't read the whole book, anything. Mm-hmm. And you will say afterwards, boy, did I profit from that one.
Yeah.
That's good. We are at time for our break, so we're going to go ahead and take that, and we'll be back in just a moment. Hey, welcome to our break. I'm going to talk about something that we've done the last 3 weeks, but is going to still be available for order, I think only till the end of January is what I'm going to do, and then from there I'm going to reassess and see how things went, and that is the Thinking Fellows Bundle. Many of you have already pre-ordered it, so that's really cool. That'll get shipped out late January is when I will be sending those orders out. And we gave away 5, and they were all collected. So that was really cool. That happened pretty quickly within the afternoon of launching the episode that first day. So 5 lucky listeners, you know who you are going to be sent the bundle at the same time when the pre-orders come out. So if you've been like patiently waiting in the mail since you emailed me last week, I'm sorry, it hasn't shipped yet. I'm still building those up. So please wait. So I'm just going to outline what's available in that bundle and where you can get it. Okay, so in the bundle is a copy of the second edition of Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace. It is the hardcover edition with the new cover art, which is absolutely, I think, stunning. I think it's a great-looking book. It matches some of the best publishers out there as far as quality look in the book. You have Resurrection Fact, which Dr. Francisco is co-editor and an author of one of the chapters and an excerpt in there. So that is fantastic apologetic work. I think it is one of the most helpful modern works on apologetics because it gets kind of to the core of the matter and it tackles, I think, the major academic thought against the resurrection of Christ right now. Recently, it was helpful for me. I got kind of dragged into a little debate with it's actually like a forum of atheists online.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Which was interesting because usually when you run into people, they're just agnostic, so they're usually open to hearing what you have to say, and even if they're not going to really consider it at heart, but they'll listen. These people were like actual apologists for
zealous
atheism.
Atheists, too.
And they brought up,
and the conversation never goes.
If you were to look at the table of the resurrection fact, those were the points that they were bringing up to the table.
So that's why we chose those topics.
You go. So that if you're going to be doing...
Wait a minute, you had a plan?
Wow.
If you're going to be doing apologetics with somebody who knows their stuff, or you're talking to somebody who knows their stuff, this book will help arm you with at least some good ground level rooted knowledge. And then last in that book is Dr. Rosenblatt's Christ Alone. That is a book, but it's in a compact form. So you can carry it around with you in your bag and you can give it away. You can, if you already have a couple, because we've given them away at conferences and things like that. So if you have a copy of any of these, I still think it's worth it to buy the bundle because you might not own the other two. And then you can give away your extra copy of whatever you had. So let's say you already own Being Dad, but you don't own Resurrection Fact or Christ Alone. Well, give away that extra copy of Being Dad and get those two books for yourself. And I think that's a pretty good idea. Additionally, while supplies last, there will be a Thinking Fellows notebook and some 1517/Thinking Fellows stickers in there as well. And not as many, there haven't been so many orders that those booklets have run out yet. So you still have a chance to get a Thinking Fellows notebook. So... get on those orders.
Can I have a notebook?
Yeah, you can have a notebook.
Okay. They're $5.99 for you.
Ooh, pricey. One more note before we jump back into the normal meat of the show here is that you may hear some rain noise. In Southern California, as you may know from the news, it doesn't rain very much lately. In fact, we've been in kind of...
11 months, no rain.
11 months with no serious rain. And today... it's pouring, and so you may be hearing the rain aggressively fall on the roof here. We have no idea. I won't know until editing whether this made it in or not. If it did, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can do about it. Force of God and all that. So, and I just forgot to mention that the Thinking Fellows bundle, as usual, is going to be at shop.1517legacy.com, and it's always in the show notes. So if you're not using the show notes, you really should. So if you listen on your phone, it's on every podcasting app. Either swipe down or turn around the cover art, and there should be some form of the show notes there with linkable material. If you listen on our website on your computer, or if you listen on your phone and you want to go look at the show notes on your computer, go to thinkingfellows.com. You'll see the most recent episodes there. You click on it, and the show notes are linked all up in there. And we have a new system on the Thinking Fellows website. So even if you use your phone and you've never been to the Thinking Fellows website, you may want to consider it now because in every episode, the featured product that I did at the break, if it's a 1517 Legacy product, will have a checkout button on the Thinking Fellows website. This means that instead of having to go to two different websites to buy whatever book it is, if you're on the Thinking Fellows website, you can check out directly there from the 1517 store. That's a great new addition to our website. Very welcome. Thank you to Doug Clambara, who made that possible and made all the new changes to the website possible. If you go check it out, we have a new archiving system that makes it very easy to see episodes that are of like categories. So I think you'll enjoy that. That's thinkingfellows.com. Remember to subscribe so that you can get show notes. Okay, so back to the normal episode. We kind of left off. We did just some basic, like, the big things that Lewis covered. We did sort of the introductory to apologetics. But I think it'd be good. We talked about slightly that he is a late convert to Christianity. But is there more to that? So what was the portion, like, how did... that come to be? So I think in a couple of his books he talks about his rebellion against it, and then
the big one is Surprised by Joy. Right, so it is an autobiography, but it's really the story of his conversion to Christianity,
and it ends with
his conversion. And there's in I think there's two, he says there's two ways that he came to the faith. One of them was by reading his favorite author, George MacDonald, and some of the works, and specifically the poetry of George MacDonald and
G.K. Chesterton.
G.K. Chesterton as well. And that these men, in sort of roundabout and sometimes very specific ways, provided arguments for the faith that he had a hard time getting around.
Mm-hmm. One student asked him one time when he was an Hegelian, "Professor Lewis, how do you live daily in idealism?" He was devastated. Ooh. When he thought about it, he was devastated.
Right.
Had no place to go.
Do you know what is there a particular collection from George MacDonald that I might be able to add to the show notes or anything that?
I think there. I'll find it and send it to you. But there's a compendium of his poetry that I think would sort of suffice. There's some things that George MacDonald wrote that have to do with father.
Yeah.
That was very meaningful to him.
There are I think sub collections. Where they've drawn from various of his books and put them into...
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, compendium format.
Yeah. and then with G.K. Chesterton, I mean, you're probably... I would guess you're talking about some of his works like Orthodoxy and...
Certainly.
Yeah.
Lewis would say something like, if there's anything I ever wrote that was worthwhile, I stole it from either MacDonald or from Chesterton.
Right. If you read any Chesterton, even again in a compendium form, it's very difficult to get around the fact that he's arguing for the veracity and the truth of the Christian faith
in its Roman form.
Yeah, which is not always as obvious with him, other than when he mentions it.
Yep.
But just from beginning to end. I mean, if he's talking about the family, he's arguing for the faith. If he's talking about your interaction society, he's arguing for the faith. It's everywhere.
He could have been on either faculty, Oxford or Cambridge, easily. Didn't want to. He wanted to argue the faith in the daily newspaper.
Hey, we'd call him a journalist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, or I don't know what...
An editor, a contributing editor or something
to
like
the
that.
Opinion page or something.
But he essentially wrote editorials his whole
life. Yes, that's right. That's right.
That
and
was
well,
his career.
the Father Brown mystery stories, you might know him from his mystery stories. But what he wanted to do was argue that Christianity was true, and he wanted to do it at the street level, not at the university. We happen to have an expert in our circle on Chesterton. His name is Rick Ritchie.
No kidding.
Yeah. That's who I went to when I was doing my year of Chesterton.
Sure.
A year.
Well, a year I tried to spend a year reading everything I get my hands on from him. Mm-hmm.
Before we go too far, you mentioned I'm kind of conscious of something because we had this episode on defining our terms.
Yeah.
And Dr. Rosenblatt referred to C.S. Lewis as a Hegelian and an idealist. Could we define that?
Very good.
And why Lewis would have been devastated by that question?
I'm not sure about that question, but an Hegelian is someone, it was very much in vogue in academic circles in the late 19th century, Georg Hegel, the German. And idealism is philosophically a position that the most real entities in the universe are mental ideas, more real than the table at which you're sitting or the roof over your head.
So like extreme Platonism?
Yes. Yeah.
But with a very specific construction. That'd be the difference, I'd say, is that you're still talking about a very top-down from the greater idea, possibly eventually to a specific. But within Hegelianism and idealism, you have no problem writing out like a specific plan from the universe that erupts from your head.
Yep. 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 And to somebody like me, who spent almost all of his years in the natural sciences and none in philosophy, it sounds like insanity. But in philosophical circles, it comes back again and again and again and again. Idealism, not in the sense of a naive optimism, but in the philosophical sense. Also, who was it? Berkeley.
Yeah.
Barclay also, who confounds me. I'll go to Rick Ritchie to explain Barclay for me, how it seems like things are popping in and out of the universe during the nighttime. I have to go to Rick and say, tell me again why Barclay was so brilliant. It's not in vogue now. Strong empiricism has been, since the beginning of the Enlightenment, sort of on a tear. And Hegel and idealism are sort of overrun. But philosophy has a way of not going to something else because something's been refuted so much as one author said, it goes out of vogue.
It goes out of style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, out of style.
It's like, you know, I went from wearing Vans to Converse.
Yeah. Yeah. Who'da thunk?
Yeah. To your question on George MacDonald, there's actually a collection of writings of C.S. Lewis about George MacDonald a C.S. Lewis book called George MacDonald that's pretty easy to find. And I'd say that the one big one, if our listeners wanted to read one that Lewis mentions quite a bit, is Fantastes.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely.
Lilith or Fantastes.
Yeah. With G.K. Chesterton, I would guess Orthodoxy was a big influence, probably The Everlasting Man as well.
Yes, those are the two big ones.
You know, other than that, when he says that everything I wrote, you can probably trace back to him. Just get your hands on what you can that's Chesterton and do your best to read it. I was thinking that before the break it'd be important. There's a couple of really good biographies that are fairly recent, both on Lewis and on the Inklings generally. The one I read in, I think, 2016 called The Fellowship, which is the literary lives of the Inklings, J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Owen Barfield, and Charles Williams, was very good. I enjoyed it a lot. It's by Philip and Carol Zaleski. I think we should throw that up in the show notes. And then Adam's supervisor at Oxford, Alistair McGrath, again in 2016, he came out with two biographies of Lewis, but the popular level one, which is certainly popular level enough at almost 400 pages, is C.S. Lewis, A Life. Uh-huh. It's very much worth reading. There are also several lectures that McGrath gives on the book as he sort of went out on the book tour that you can find on YouTube.
And there's a wonderful audio series from the teaching company. Mm-hmm. A young fellow, I think, at Baylor. And I'm a Lewis fan, as I said, just as are thousands of others. But I listened to that whole series on Lewis from that young man at Baylor, and I don't know one single error. Mm. Mm. It was every sentence that came out of his mouth was informed, and it was accurate.
Hillsdale College did one, too, that I'd sort of give a solid
yes.
B to.
Uh-huh. I listened to one, and it was typically making Lewis obfuscated because this particular lecture did what academics so often do. Took someone who was utterly lucid
and made him ununderstandable.
And made him obscure. Yeah, but I only listened to one. I thought I'll try one.
Hey, do you think it'd be worth our listeners' time to maybe kind of list out some of Lewis's books and say what they're generally about?
And also, my students over 30 years have done outlines of almost all of his books, minus the ones in English literature. And those are going to be available at 1517, inexpensively. It's going to be much broader than Lewis, but Lewis is one stream of book outlines. And the intent of these is not, of course, to replace reading the book, but it's to give you a little more idea of what's in it than a table of contents would.
Mm-hmm. And I have tried to make my way through some of Lewis's scholarly works on literature and literary criticism. Like an experiment in criticism, unless you're somebody that's very well trained in literature, it's a tough road to hoe, man.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I tried to do that a couple years ago too. Hey, I want to start with it's going to be weird. I mean, I think everyone's aware basically of the Chronicles of Narnia, right? So if you're not, you ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
They were written for children, so if you're an adult and you have not read them, I'd say you could probably read each one in about a 4 to 5 hour time
period. They're like 110 pages a piece.
And it covers every major Christian doctrine.
It's glorious.
In mythic form. It is glorious.
Yeah, I mean, still, when I think of a sort of a doctrine of creation or a doctrine of eschatology,
yep.
I go both to the Magician's Nephew and the Last Battle.
Yep.
In my head, that's where
yep.
I go.
And you and thousands of others.
Yeah. I mean, and in between there, you have just some...
The Atonement.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
The Lion, really, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Right. Is way better well done than you would... I mean, and every time I revisit it, or even the movies do a good job, I think, of even capturing that aspect.
It actually did. It actually
if
did.
If you're watching it with that in mind, it is very helpful because you actually get many of the metaphors and narratives of the Atonement in there. And see, and he does such a fantastic job wrapping it all into one event.
Yeah.
One event. Yeah, yep. It's really good. Mere Christianity, which is the expanded sort of version of the Case for Christianity to which we referred earlier.
It's three separate books, and some idiot at Macmillan in London said, why don't we glue three of these together?
Yeah.
It's three separate books. They were published in very small hardback when they first came out, and it makes it difficult for the non-Christian when you recommend it because it's massive or it's substantial.
It's bigger, at least. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a couple hundred pages.
If I ever see individual little paperbacks of The Case for Christianity, I buy 10 of them because I give them away.
You can get it. You can get Case for Christianity, I think, through Macmillan, too, now.
Okay.
So you can get it separate or you can get it bundled in Mere Christianity.
That's the kind of thing that the non-Christian can look at and say, I could knock that out this weekend.
Oh,
and he's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff's going to become more available because it's been over 50 years now since he's died. And in many countries, that's when copyright ends. And so you'll be able to get publication. Somebody could theoretically split those up and republish them in countries that have it, like Canada, and there's a couple other
yeah,
places.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Mere Christianity, the three books, The Case for Christianity is the first one, What Christians Believe, I think, was the second one, and the third one was...
You're testing me, Rod.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It covers like ethics or the Christian
yeah,
way,
so
yeah. something like that.
You wouldn't say this, but it very much follows a law gospel model in an interesting sort of way.
Yeah.
Because it's the middle book where you actually get the explanation of the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to get to a couple, but Screwtape Letters.
Absolutely. It shot him into fame, and he knew his academic progress ended as soon as it came out, and he was right. In England, the class structure is so strong that you do not write for the rabble. And Lewis decided to write for us rabble. And he was right. That stopped his academic progress. That's beneath you to do.
For years. I mean, until he was moved to Cambridge near the end of his life.
Yep.
Yeah.
Stuffed shirts.
It's still the case there. And I know at Oxford, there was always this sort of, I don't know if disdain is probably too strong of a word, but there's people just sort of turn their noses up at somebody who had left writing all these specialized journal articles with the jargon and so on and starting to write popular books, even if it was like the accomplished historian or theologian.
Yeah, and say it sold a million, that even increases the condemnation.
Yeah, because it's popular level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, but if you're making money, it might not matter.
Well, there you go. So Screwtape Letters is basically two demons who are cavorting on the spiritual tack of a lowly Christian.
Patient.
Yeah, patient, right? And are sort of having a conversation about what's working and not working.
Yep. Everything is negative. It's flipped.
To draw him out of the faith.
Yep.
You know, and... It talks about patience and, you know, this too will pass sort of things that as he's encouraging the faith. That's great. We already referred to the Great Divorce, basically a theology of heaven in story form.
Getting a second chance and people turn it down again.
We also already talked about the abolition of man. Many ethicists really are using this to say, or virtue ethicists really refer back to this, Christian ones at least, as sort of a basis for what they're trying to argue. But what you have there is he's going at the educational system of his time.
For
teaching students that there's no objectivity.
Yep.
The four loves. Lewis examines the four Greek words that we translate into love, and it's marvelous. If you don't feel like you have the time to read the whole thing, read the chapter on philia, and it'll knock your socks off. Mm-hmm. I bet you can go back to the other chapters once you're done with philia. A grief observed. Yeah, he writes after the death of his wife, Joy.
And he didn't write it to publish it. He said he wrote it to keep from going mad.
Yeah.
It's strong medicine. Lewis is arguing Lewis out of the faith.
Right.
Not the kind of thing you'd give to somebody who just lost somebody they love.
No, because he's devastated when he writes this.
Yeah, he's absolutely devastated. Yeah. And he sort of, background makes fun of his earlier book, The Problem of Pain, but he shouldn't. Yeah. It's a good book.
Yeah, so those are two I wanted to go to next, The Problem of Pain and Miracles.
Yep. Both apologetic in nature.
Yep. Absolutely, yeah.
Yep.
Miracles is straight apologetics, really. I mean, he's arguing for the possible truth claims that exist within the miraculous.
Can you ground a religion intelligently in a miracle claim?
Right. The one that I avoided for years, and it's probably your fault, Rod, is just the way they is the space trilogy. I avoided it for just years. Just because it's not easy. I'd say if people want to read, it's not. I don't think it's easy reading, especially not.
You know, the level isn't that hard, but the pace is sometimes when I've tried to go at it difficult to overcome. Especially like in the iPhone world, where you have a lot of distractions that can draw you away from the book. I just find it is slower to pull you in.
There's a power off button on the iPhone, you know.
second one of the three, Paralandra.
Paralandra, yeah.
Yeah.
Is probably the best commentary on Genesis.
On Genesis.
That you will ever read.
Right.
And here it is in a, quote, sci-fi book by an Englishman.
Oh, it's wonderful.
But
it's wonderful.
Boy, you talk about getting across unfallen to fallen. And what streams out of that?
If you go, so the first one in the book is Out of the Silent Planet. The second book in the trilogy is Paralandria. The third book in the trilogy is That Hideous Strength. The first book, you're basically getting the story of an unfallen world. I was going to say pre-fallen, but I think unfallen is more accurate. So what happens when fallen creatures come into an unfallen world and meet these creations of the same God, who have not fallen into sin, and what impact do we as fallen creatures have on them?
Yep.
And the thing that's a genius, I think, I would say I avoided it because some things you said when I was an undergrad, read it about 10 years later, reread it twice in 2016, the whole trilogy, just because That Hideous Strength kicked my butt. But the thing I love about Out of the Silent Planet, it's probably one of my favorite of his writings now. What I love about Out of the Silent Planet is that both the obviously guilty parties and the one ransom that you would consider the quote-unquote innocent parties have affected the unfallen world with their infected the unfallen world with their sin.
Yep.
And I think that's easy to miss in that book because Ransom's a hero.
Yep.
But he is chastised as much for his own for his actions as is the obvious bad guy, or are the obvious bad guys in the story. I mean, it's just glorious. Paralandria, it's the story of Genesis.
Yeah.
Really. It's really the story of the fall.
Yeah.
I'd say. I mean, it's...
Yeah,
it's,
the first few chapters of Genesis.
It's the 200 and some odd pages on that time that we don't know about when the serpent was talking to Eve when she was separated from Adam for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty good. That Hideous Strength... the way you described it when I was an undergrad was the best insight into what the academic life is really like. And I thought, it kind of is.
it's an introduction into not just academia in a sort of formal way, but it's a tragic story of the political world gone sick. Now, that's an undercurrent, but it's there. Some of the evil that you can do in having a passion to lead the rest of us and what to avoid. In that urging to do something really great for the rabble, you can make some really, really deep and awful errors.
Right. Well, it's got a glorious ending, but it's got a glorious sort of unsung ending. I'll say it that way. But it's a tough read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Discouraging in some ways, but he intended that.
Yeah.
Welcome to a world of discouragement.
Yeah, that's what's great about it, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. All right, guys, we are running out of time, but this was a fantastic episode. I'm really glad we are, that the show programming is like at this now, where we can revisit so many different categories every month and get to things that we perhaps missed that people wanted to do. If you're a listener of the show, we love your feedback. We love your questions. You can send them at the contact button on the Thinking Fellows website. You can send them via Facebook message or Twitter or however you would like. And I try my best to respond to those in a timely manner and or forward questions off to the fellows. If somebody or I choose not to have your question answered right away, it's probably because I'm saving it to use in an episode. And I'll typically try to let you know that, and that might leave you kind of cliffhangery at the moment. But sometimes we get so many of the same type that it becomes apparent that we need to cover it on the show. And so just keep that in mind as you send me those messages and whatever questions you may have. Once again, thank you for listening to the show. We're glad that you join us every week, and we hope that you continue to listen. Thank you, and we'll catch you next time.